You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The deaths of African Americans at the hands of police has been a catalyst for demonstrations, protests, and riots across the country for many decades. But with the emergence of cell phone videos and social media, a new kind of narrative and a new kind of activist has emerged. Wesley Lowery, a Pulitzer Prize-winning national reporter for The Washington Post, has been on the front lines of all the major stories concerning this new political movement and the emergence of Black Lives Matters, and he writes about them in his new book called They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. It's published by Little Brown. I'm very pleased he is able to join us today. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
You write that you first heard about Michael Brown in Ferguson through Brittany Noble, a local news reporter. Can you tell us a little bit about Brittany and how she was able to capture the first days after the death of Michael Brown?
Of course. And one of the reasons I include that story in the book is because it speaks to kind of, especially for people who are digitally inclined, who are using Instagram or Twitter or Facebook, how these stories organically thrust themselves into our lives. I was at my grandparents' house in Detroit scrolling Instagram over the weekend, and Brittany was a friend of mine. I'd known her for years. We met at a journalism conference, and she was a local reporter in St. Louis who, on that day, actually was at her engagement photo shoot, but she lived in Ferguson. Her sources started texting her and calling her, did you hear about this police shooting? Did you hear what was going on? And so she turned over to her now husband, Mike, who's a great guy too, and she goes, you know, I gotta leave, right? And dashes off from her engagement photo shoot to go to the scene of where Michael Brown's been killed. Now, what she did that was smart was, amidst this chaos, because at this point you've got Michael Brown's body is still laying on the ground. It ended up there for 4.5 hours in Ferguson, right? You have the police who are starting to try to cordon off the area, and you have the angry residents who are surrounding what's going on, demanding answers, and there aren't any answers to be had. No one's telling them anything. She started doing interviews, and she got one of the first interviews ever with Michael Brown's mother. As she's still grieving, she's at the scene. We've seen the video, and she put this video out on social media. It wasn't something that they saved for the 7 o'clock newscast, but that she immediately captured this pain and this anger, and that really ended up being a lot of the story of Ferguson. It was captured so beautifully on her cell phone.
Were you asked to go to Ferguson and report on the protests, or did you have to make your case to your editors at the Post?
I was asked, and so at the time, I was covering Congress. I was a political reporter. I wasn't a national correspondent, but I did do a lot of travel, and I had just gotten back from a trip to Michigan on a congressional race that no one remembers anymore. It was a congressional primary, and I had always, while I was doing politics, I'd always had an interest in issues of race and issues of justice. So on the Hill, I might cover, for example, the president's civil rights appointee or something like that.
There have been protests by some African-American journalists that they always get assigned to the race issues. But this is something that you would have preferred?
Of course. No, I think these stories are important. And I think that it's important to have people who can bring the humanity out of the people being covered, telling these stories. And I think it's important to have Black journalists telling these stories. That's a conversation we have all the time in Black journalism spaces. Are we going to get pigeonholed? Are you going to get stuck on this? And you know, my not the most humble answer ever, but I think that, you know, look, I'm good enough to cover these stories well, and tomorrow I can cover a different set of stories too.
How old were you during that first assignment in Ferguson?
So
was there a problem when you needed to rent a car?
I was 24 years old when I first arrived. Although, like I said, I'd been doing some travel, so I'd figured out all of the little tricks of the trade. Like, all right, from this rental car company, if I do it this way with a corporate card instead of a debt, you know, I had figured out all of it out. But there were some, you know, I was certainly very young. I had been at the Post at that point for a little under a year, at the Boston Globe prior to that. And so it was a large, massive story. Think about Ferguson and all my colleagues, both at the Post and from other publications who covered it. When we get together, we always talk about how it was such a – it was a story where in the moment you knew it was bigger than what you were looking at.
And many listeners will remember that there was a reporter who was arrested at McDonald's.
I don't know who
that is. That was you?
Yes, myself and Ryan Riley of the Huffington Post, who at the time, who I met that day and who is now a very good friend of mine. But we were among, I mean, eventually there were about 2-3 dozen reporters at some point taken to custody, but we were among the first. And so
what was the charge?
trespassing. So essentially what happened is we were, for people who don't travel as reporters, you might not, why are they hanging out at McDonald's? You know, my doctor might not be happy to hear that. But in reality, those of us who travel as reporters, we find any place with outlets and Wi-Fi because we got a file, we're writing stories, we need to recharge. And so we were in there working. And the officers decided essentially they wanted to clear every building along the street in advance of what they thought might turn violent. You know, there was at the time a peaceful protest happening outside. They came in, they kind of made some demands. They got frustrated that we weren't leaving quickly enough for them. And so they said, whatever, put them in cuffs. And that ended up not working out so well for anyone.
And I assume you asked them, why are you doing this? And asked them some other questions.
Yes,
did they respond?
They were not particularly inclined to respond to our questions. At the time, I mean, it was a very unpleasant interaction, and you get it, right? You understand that here you have police officers who it's been days of tense protest, tense criticism. They don't know what's going on. Now these people are asking them questions, and they just want you to leave. But it seemed to blow up very quickly. We ended up in custody, although later released.
How long were you in jail?
An hour or two. But by the time we even got to the jail, other reporters had seen that we were being arrested and started inundating with the police with calls about what had happened, what was going on. There was a massive kind of social media outrage about this. And I think that it really raised this question for a lot of people, right? That by the time we were arrested on August 13th. That's 4 days after Michael Brown was killed. And the media hadn't paid a ton of attention to how the local people were being treated. They were being tear gassed. They were being arrested. They were being rounded up. But that raised this question of, if the police in Ferguson were going to treat these two pretty boy reporters from D.C. this way, how must they be treating all these other people?
So if not for social media, do you think that you would have been in jail a lot longer?
I trust that my friends, the Washington Post attorneys, would have sprung me out soon enough. But
and no charges.
We were eventually charged. They waited a year until the last day of their statute of limitations. They filed charges, which they later dropped because they were ridiculous.
My guess is Wesley Lowery, his book, They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. In Ferguson, there were conflicting views about Michael Brown.
Of course.
His family called him a gentle giant. The police released footage of him robbing a liquor store, and they said that he had attacked the police officer who shot him. Did these conflicting stories make it difficult to write about the situation objectively?
It made it difficult to write about the situation in a way that brought clarity and understanding, right? Because you had that, because the stories were conflicting, the news coverage was so focused on validating one story or the other rather than zooming out to the 10,000 or 100,000 feet, right? So, because the lesson of Ferguson is it has nothing to do with whether Michael Brown's hands are up or down, right? That's actually not the lesson of Ferguson. The lessons of Ferguson are lessons about how deep this distrust existed, about how do you treat people in a way, whether Michael Brown's shooting was justified or unjustified, legally or morally or otherwise, right? Should his body have been left out for so long? Did the public have a right to information? That's what we forget now, is that for the first week, people are chanting, what's his name? They wouldn't name the police officer, right? And so much of the conversation should have been about police transparency and the need to provide residents with information. Instead, we got stuck in this up, down, midway up, where exactly were Michael Brown's hands when he was killed conversation.
And as you were covering the protest, didn't many of Ferguson's residents say that their protests were about a lot more than Michael Brown? What were they protesting, the traffic stops and things like that?
Of course. I mean, at the fundamental level, it's about humanity. It's about how police are treating people. And so we heard stories about traffic stops, about warrants, how at the time Michael Brown was killed, the city of Ferguson had more outstanding warrants than it had residents, right? That this was a tax on people who were otherwise living paycheck to paycheck, knowing that if they got pulled over, they could end up getting thrown in jail on a warrant. I mean, and what we've also seen, though, is that the story of Ferguson is the story of America, and I think that's kind of what I try to walk through in this book, that when Ferguson first happened, everyone looked at Ferguson and said, well, that place must be messed up, that the racist over there, crazy place. And then it happens in New York, and then it happens in Cleveland, then it happens in Milwaukee, then it happens in Charlotte, we can't throw stones from a glass house here. The same breakdown of relationship between police and black and brown communities exist in every municipality.
And since you covered all those stories, I was thinking they should call you Zelig on the side. would the concerns of the people of Ferguson have made the news if Michael Brown hadn't been killed?
Probably not. And I think that's one of the things that all of the story, you know, there's a lot of great journalism that came after. And that often comes after one of these shootings, right? After Ferguson, we get all this great reporting on the segregation of St. Louis. We get all this great reporting on the traffic stops and the court systems that are, you know. But all of those things existed the day before Michael Brown was killed, right? And that in many ways, people coming to the streets is what brought our attention. It's unfortunate. We weren't covering the story just because he was killed. It wasn't until the gas station got burned down that we even showed up.
Have things changed much there? I remember Jackie Robinson hating to go to St. Louis to play the Cardinals when he was with the Dodgers because that's where the crowds would yell the most terrible racial epithets at him.
One of the things that I've done a lot of reading on is the Jim Crow era and lynchings. And at the time, what's fascinating when you read about these towns and these cities where a high-profile lynching would take place is that everyone else in the country would be horrified by this thing and learning lessons and starting commissions and the people who lived in the town where the lynching had happened could never get over it. They would say the media made all this up. We're not really like this. They'd seen themselves become the caricature of racist America, and they didn't like it. And I think that, you know, certainly some things are changing in St. Louis. There's certainly some things changing in Ferguson. But there's, when I go back, there still is certainly a bitterness from many of the residents I talked to that they feel like they were dealt, that they've been made the villains of history. And none of us really like that, whether it's true or not.
One of your sources in Ferguson was Jonetta Elzey, and she initially didn't trust the media because of the way the local press covered the death of a friend of hers, Stefan Avery Hart. Now, what happened there? Was that a story that would have been like a Michael Brown story if somebody had had a camera at the time?
So it's a case where this is a shooting that happened months before. It's one of the last fatal police shootings in Greater St. Louis prior to Michael Brown. And Stefan Avery Hart is a young man who was getting pulled over, knew he had an outstanding traffic warrant, and so ran from the police officers. And what we know in that case is that he goes to he was running from the officers, and he had a gun that he owned legally with him. He goes to throw it over a fence, and it hits the top of the fence and falls back down on his feet. And as he's going to pick it back up to, who knows, either throw it back or run again, the police officer is chasing him round the corner, seeing him reaching for this gun. They open fire. Now, we only know that because of a report that I acquired that isn't even really public information yet, that investigation from before Michael Brown is still pending, still active. This is one of those cases where, again, this happened before Michael Brown was killed, and there's still no answers for his family.
You also covered the grand jury decision in Ferguson. Mm-hmm. Where were you when the decision was finally announced?
So during the announcement, I was in an apartment downtown in St. Louis, surrounded by young people from St. Louis who had been residents and who became activists. Jonetta Elzey was there. DeRay McKesson, who is now one of the more prominent activists, was there. Brittany Packnett, who's on the president's White House Commission on Policing, was there. And I sat as a fly on the wall and watched them watch the decision, watched them throw paper balls at Nancy Grace as they were getting upset with the commentators. And watching, you know, by the time the grand jury decision came out, most of us knew Darren Wilson would not be charged in Ferguson. But there was still that moment of heartbreak for so many people where I didn't think the system was going to work for me. I didn't think justice was going to be served, those people who believe that Darren Wilson should have been charged. But they still, in the back of the mind, thought, maybe. And you watch that shatter. And then moments later, violence erupted in the streets.
I'm speaking with Wesley Lowery, who's a national reporter for The Washington Post, covers law enforcement and justice. He has written a book called They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. It is published by Little Brown. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Pulitzer Prize winning reporter for The Washington Post, Wesley Lowery. His book, They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement, published by Little Brown. Do you think that as a relatively young reporter, you were able to connect with some of the younger protesters and offer a different perspective about an emerging movement, which included Black Lives Matter?
Certainly. I think that, again, so much of storytelling is, can you seize and understand the humanity of someone, and can you And can you decode it and explain it to other people? And I think seeing yourself in people can be helpful for that. I mean, I would have been a high school or college classmate of many of these young activists, and so I was someone who they might have just trusted a little more naturally.
On the other hand, you were at the Washington Post, so I assume you faced a certain amount of backlash for your coverage of Ferguson from conservative political websites. What kind of stories was Breitbart News publishing about you and Black Lives Matter at the time?
Breitbart News once said that I had inflicted as much damage on black communities as the KKK had. So they compared me to the Klan for my coverage. The Daily Caller,
And what was the logic behind
that? There was little. They were mad because it was after we had been, Ryan and I had been charged, and in the statement we released afterwards, we were critical of the police and said we were shocked that they would spend their time and resources doing this, and they essentially said, look at this typical stance by Lowry again, criticizing the police who were just doing their job, the police who just charged me with a crime we didn't commit, right? But you know, other sites, like I said, the Daily Caller published my parents' home address, and so I was dealing with safety issues and security issues. There was a lot of backlash because people like to lash out at the messengers when messengers are telling them things that make them uncomfortable.
Do you take the appointment of Stephen Bannon, the former executive director of Breitbart News, as the incoming chief White House strategist and senior counselor personally?
I wouldn't say I take it personally. I mean, I think that as a American, as a journalist, as a black man, obviously that there's concern there. I mean, it's hard to imagine a world in which another president, President Obama, President Bush, would appoint someone who has promoted such fringe political views, and we would all act as if it's normal. I mean, it's clearly not normal. We have someone with real questions of whether or not they are anti-Semitic or they've promoted anti-Semitism becoming the most powerful person in the White House. There are real questions about that. But no, for a long time ago, worked very hard to stop taking a lot of this stuff personally.
You do live in Washington, so I understand.
I do.
Had you completed your work on Ferguson when you were sent to Cleveland to cover the Tamir Rice shooting?
Oh, no. I'd gotten back after the grand jury decision. I was one of the last national reporters still in Ferguson. I stayed several weeks after the grand jury decision to watch the cleanup efforts, to watch kind of a city try to piece itself back together. And as I fly back to D.C., I landed in DCA and turned my phone on, and it was buzzing nonstop. I was like, what's going on? And it had been the grand jury decision in New York for Eric Garner had come the day I came back. And so I race to the office with my bags, start making calls to activists I know up here, to activists I know in Ferguson, help out with the Eric Garner coverage, and then walk into a boss's office and say, what, you want me to go to New York? What are we doing next? And they said, don't go to New York. Go home to Cleveland. There was a...
You grew up near Cleveland?
Yes, east side of Cleveland, Shaker Heights, which is a first-ring suburb, a remarkably diverse city. My family's still there. And so they said, go home to Cleveland and tell the story of this boy who's been killed. And so the next, I think a day later, got in a plane and went home to Cleveland.
Had you been given the talk by your parents?
You know, I had been, my parents were...
So much has been made of that talk.
Of the talk. Well, it was interesting was we, when I got back, my parents and I sat in the living room. We had a conversation. And it was one of the first, I realize now, it was one of the first full conversations we had had. And I was an adult. I was returning from covering Ferguson that we had really had about race. Now, I grew up with a black father and a white mother in a mixed race home. But my dad told me, he said, you know, we didn't talk a ton about race. He goes, I have two brothers. He goes, my three sons were all smart. The world was going to let them know that they were black one day they were going to know. I didn't need to tell any of you. And I think that was a revealing conversation we had. I thought it was interesting.
You profile Alonzo Mitchell, who hosts a local radio show in Cleveland. Can you talk about him?
Of course. Alonzo's fascinating. He's a young activist in Cleveland, and he's the kind of person who we're seeing a lot of people like him in Cleveland right now. People who I have a lot of friends this way, who left to go to college, who got their first big job in D.C. or in New York, and now have saying, I want to go back to my hometown. And so he came back to Cleveland. He hosts a local radio show. He helps run the big, he emcees the New Year's Eve jam for the city in Cleveland, but he also goes to every city council meeting and sits in every city council meeting. He's someone who's very much working and talking about how can we build young power in this city? How can we turn our street activism into power in the halls of City Hall?
And he said he's not only fighting the white establishment, but also the black establishment. You write that one thing holding Midwestern cities back is the ongoing tension between different generations of black leadership.
Of course. We see this in Cleveland is a city where that is very proud from having one of the first big city black mayors, a city where the mayor's black, where the congresswoman's black, where the police chief is black. We saw this also in Baltimore, which we get to later, right? That you have a city where the police chief was black, the mayor was black. I remember during Ferguson sitting on a Meet the Press panel with Stephanie Rawlings Blake, the Baltimore mayor, and they were being held out as, if only Ferguson could get their policing together like Baltimore has it, then none of this would be happening. Well, we know the end of that story, right? And so there is a question of, it's not just about the halls of power. It's not just about who is sitting in positions and whether or not a city is run by black people or white people, Democrats or Republicans. Rather, it's about policy. It's about what decisions are being made in terms of how we are policing, who we are policing, and what we want our police doing in our society. That's what determines these relationships.
Another activist you cover in this book is Sean King and his fundraising efforts on behalf of Tamir Rice's family. Didn't he run into trouble during the first round of fundraising?
Of course. And it was, you know, what's fascinating is, and Sean King's a fascinating guy. I talked to him not infrequently. I was talking to him earlier this week. Columnist for the New York Daily News.
His ethnicity was challenged by some conservative blogs. Why?
Correct. It was the same type of attack. Now, Sean King had grown up in Kentucky with a white mother. And he eventually came out and said that what happened was he was raised by a white mother and a white father, but what happened essentially was his mother had an affair with a black man. And so here's someone who had been a columnist, who was writing a lot about issues of injustice, who it certainly was controversial at times, but who, rather than attack his arguments, critics of what he was saying attacked him personally. "Prove that you're not a fake black person," they said to this man, forcing him to have a public conversation about his mother's infidelity, decades earlier, because that was somehow fair game. That was a way that he could, I think that we've seen this consistently, that when you can't attack someone's message, you attack the messenger.
One shocking fact about the money that was collected for Tamir Rice's family is that of the $60,000 that was collected, only $20,000 actually went to the family. Mm-hmm. Doesn't the family have to apply to the courts to get the money instead of just being given it?
Of course, and that's what's
Why?
Difficult. I mean, this has become such a convoluted process. We see people so eager to give money after these shootings, right? A 12-year-old boy has been killed. We want to pay for the legal expenses. We want to pay for the funeral. And so the money starts being raised, and sometimes it's being raised by a family member. Sometimes it's being raised by an attorney. And what happens is, like most families, there are clashes sometimes. There's conflict sometimes. Sometimes the widow doesn't want the mother raising the money. Sometimes the mother doesn't want the daughter raising the money. And so you start to have these interfamily spats. At times you have different family members with different attorneys. And so now the attorneys are arguing with each other. What happened in the Tamir Rice case was there was all this money had been raised. An uncle of the family had signed off on the fundraiser, but the attorneys for the family hadn't quite signed off on it yet. And so they asked the courts to seize this money, which they ended up doing. And it ended up creating many extra steps that the family would have to go to get a hold of this money that had been raised for them.
I'm speaking with Wesley Lowery, who was a member of the team that was awarded the 2016 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for the Post's Washington Post coverage of police shootings. And now he's written a book about that called They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. It is published by Little Brown. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. It didn't seem like all that long after Tamir Rice's death that we heard about Walter Scott in North Charleston, and the Washington Post was one of the first outlets to publish his name. How did you first hear about Walter Scott and the video of his death?
Of course. So I got a call. I was beginning to work on the database project that we ended up doing for the year, and I got a call from a source of mine, from a guy, Ryan Julison, who helps work as a PR, a public relations expert. He helps work with attorneys. So he helps them reach media members. He helps write statements for these families once the media is coming at them. And he called me that day and he told me, he said, there's a video coming. It's going to be bigger than Eric Gardner. I can't give you the video yet. We're probably going to place it somewhere else, but I like working with you. Here's a heads up. Find out everything you can find out about this guy who was killed last week, Walter Scott. It's a major case. Go look at it. And
you hadn't heard about it until
no,
then?
No, because, it was, and that's the case in so many of these shootings, right? That what we know, based on the Washington Post database, is that three people are fatally shot by police every single day. we don't, you know, every 10 days an unarmed black person is shot and killed by the police. We don't hear about all of them. In fact, most of them we write off because, oh, that person was armed, they did whatever it was, they're a blip, they're a blurb in the newspaper, and then we don't fall into their stories. It's only in those rare occasions that these really can kind of crack the skin and boil over. And Walter Scott very quickly, because of this video, went from being some guy who was attacking the officer with the taser to someone who is clearly now being shown on video being shot in the back and killed.
Well, all of that, the fact that we have these phones, mm-hmm. has really changed the nature of this coverage.
Completely. Because before, it was the word of the police, the official police, the police spokesperson, the police chief, versus the non-existent word of a dead person. Now, we can watch these interactions ourselves with our own eyes.
But you write that you've received a lot of feedback from white readers who don't really understand the reasons for the large protests. Do you feel that was reflected in the way some people voted this past year?
Well, certainly. And I think that what was also reflected was, I think there's some resentment of the protests and of this activism. I think, you know, I hear from readers, people I interview sometimes. We've heard from Trump voters, people who say things like, I'm tired of hearing all this Black Lives Matter stuff. I'm tired of hearing about my privilege. I'm a middle-class white guy in Indianapolis or in Cleveland. And there's a resentment sometimes of that.
And then there's also anger at the fact that there have been a number of shootings of police officers.
Certainly. And we've seen that in Dallas. We've seen it in Baton Rouge. I mean, what we know, and we've also seen unrest, physical unrest, right? We've seen riots break out, whether it be in Ferguson, whether it be in Baltimore, Milwaukee, Charlotte. That scares people, right? That upsets people. And we've seen this. We saw this in 68 with Nixon. We see a return and a desire, especially among white members of the electorate, they had a desire for kind of law and order policies when it feels like things are being thrust into chaos.
You mentioned a database that you and your colleagues at the Washington Post created. Mm-hmm. What are you doing there?
So what we've done is after Ferguson, we created this database where we seek to, in real time, track every single fatal police shooting. One thing we were very surprised about when we started covering this was that no one was comprehensively across the country, no federal government agency was keeping track of this. In fact, the people doing the best attempts at this were citizen journalists kind of crowdsourcing this work themselves.
And not the DOJ.
Not the DOJ, exactly. And so that was surprising to us. So we got around the table and started having this conversation. Is this something we could do? Our friends at the Guardian newspaper did a similar project where they sought to do the same thing. And so it was just we started that in 2015. We did all of last year. That was the project for which we won the Pulitzer Prize. And we've continued it so far this year.
When you were in North Charleston, you were one of the first people to get an interview with Walter Scott's mother. And I always wonder about those interviews right after a tragic situation. In the past, reporters were made fun of saying, how do you feel? Mm-hmm. How do you treat something like that with sensitivity?
It's so difficult because it requires a level of street smarts and humanity at a time where you're very often operating in a pack. Where if one reporter handles this the wrong way, if one person is insensitive about this, it can kind of besmirch the entirety of the group. And so what was the Walter Scott interviews were valuable in part because it was just a handful of reporters who happened to be there around the same time. Most of us newspaper people who tend to have a little sensibility that way. And we were able to kind of slowly have a conversation where you allow the person to say what, you know, I think that too often we fall into these scripted questions. Well, how do you feel? And can you tell me a little bit about? And I think very often conversations wouldn't work very well that way. Your interviews wouldn't work very well if you ask the same five questions every time.
Oh, I do.
I think that there's something to be said for, you know, feeling the person in the moment and understanding who they are and reading their body language and building a connection. And I think that that's, you know, We ask so much of these families. In the moments after their loved one's been killed, we shove a microphone in their face, and we stand camp out in their front lawns, and we demand all this information from them. And I think that one of the biggest lessons here is to try to prioritize their humanity.
When you watch other reporters at work, when you're in Baltimore, for example, and you saw Geraldo Rivera on the streets, what was he doing?
In Baltimore, there was a scene, and it ended up going viral, but Geraldo is on the streets of Baltimore with a Fox News kit, walking around interviewing people. And there's a young man, Kwame Rose, who ends up becoming a prominent activist, but at the time is just a guy. And he shows up And he starts yelling at Geraldo, "Get out of here. We don't want you here. Get your camera as well." And Geraldo's kind of running away from him. And eventually he stops, and they kind of have this moment where they're yelling back and forth at each other. And Kwame's talking to him, and he's saying, he's vocalizing this frustration with the media. "You weren't here covering these rundown houses before we burned a CVS down. You weren't here covering the lead in our paint and in our water before there was a riot. But now you want to come here and make us look like animals." What's remarkable for those of us in the media, the lesson we have to remember as we cover this distrust between communities and the police, is that these communities distrust us just as much, if not more, and that we are often complacent in some of these issues.
You also wrote about positive police-community relations in Fresno.
Mm-hmm.
What was the response to that? What kind
of course.
Feedback
so,
did you
so
get?
I went to Fresno before Baltimore, between Walter Scott and Freddie Gray. I went to Fresno because I was in search of a community policing story. I wanted to find a place that was doing this well and doing this the right way, right? And I had a tip from a good source of mine. Hey, they've got a good program here. They've been partnering. They've been doing work. And it was a good program that Fresno police have done for years, where they host block parties every Saturday of the summer in some of their roughest neighborhoods. And they think that it's really helped them drive down gang crime. But as I wrote this piece, I was so hungry for this counter narrative. I'd had like 6 months of people telling me I hate the police and I only write bad, that I put too much of a rose-colored glass on my framing of this story. And so I started hearing from local activists, like, "Dude, what's wrong with you? Like, why didn't you call me about this? I can't stand the police here. I think they're still the problem." And so it's too often, I think, we go searching for a story to fit the narrative we've already decided. I decided I wanted a positive story before I actually got there and talked to people. And so I ended up with a positive story. Whether it was accurate or not is a different question.
At one point in my life, I spent a fair amount of time in Fresno. What I remember is that it was 105 degrees every day at 1 o'clock in the summertime.
It was warm.
My thanks to you for being on our show, Wesley Lowery, part of the Pulitzer Prize-winning team covering racial matters. And now he's written a book called They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and the New Era of America's Racial Justice Movement. It's published by Little Brown. It's been a pleasure having you on our
show. Thanks so much for having me.